Hi, I'm attorney Barry Boykin.
I'm attorney Kevin Johnson. Welcome to episode 38 of Dynamite Divorce and Other Matters. We're very fortunate to have with us a special guest, attorney Claire McMahon from Chicago. Welcome, Claire.
Thank you, Kevin. Thank you for having me.
So we've dragged Claire into our subterranean recording studio and given her an old office chair to sit on here. It's creaky. You might hear that in the background. We're glad that she could spend this time to come to us to talk about family law. Now, family law ends up being very complicated. And for our listeners, sometimes it can be overwhelming. So we've come to try to offer up some more simplified or at least everyday explanations of some of the stuff we see on a regular basis as experienced practitioners. Before we go further,
this podcast is no substitute for the specific legal advice you will get by consulting one-on-one with a licensed attorney in your state or country. We hope that before taking any action that might change your life or your financial situation, and before making decisions that might significantly affect your children and the people around you, you do find and meet with a licensed attorney.
Now on with the show. Barry, do you mind if I introduce, I was talking about a topic before the pod. Do you mind if I introduce that topic?
Oh, go right ahead.
Okay. The topic I was thinking of was best ideas in family law or worst ideas in family law. And what I'm talking about is we as practitioners roaming the hallways of the court system and also, as you know, burning up Zoom time now with remote court, often see different ways that people approach cases. We see the ways that attorneys do things, and there's a lot of problems to be solved. So we see the way that attorneys solve these problems or attempt to, and we see the ways that pro se or self-represented people solve problems. So I thought today we could at least offer up some of the best techniques we've seen and some of the things that we know don't work, or while maybe widely practiced, we go, it's like, why do people do that, right? So we better start with our usual background. Could you please tell us a little bit about yourself, Claire?
Sure, Kevin, no problem. Kevin and Barry know me pretty well, but I've been practicing well over a decade. I'm a Chicago native. I went to undergrad on the West Coast, and I have my law degree from Chicago Kent College of Law right here in the Chicagoland area. I pretty much have done family law the whole time that I have been a lawyer. I started working for family law offices when I was in law school, and I love the work, and I still do it today. Currently, I am an attorney at a law firm called Hoffenberg & Block, which is it's a small size firm. It's less than 10 lawyers. I love all the lawyers in my office. We do great work. We're located right in downtown Chicago, and we're happy to help. So that's a little bit about me.
So what made you be interested in family law?
Honestly, I got it by lottery. So in law school, we had these classes where you could sort of get classroom credit for working in a law firm setting. And they had like lawyers that basically ran law firms out of the school so that you would have a professor who was teaching you how to do it right. You sort of had a few different topics and you ranked your topics by which ones you wanted. And I got put in family law for whatever reason. And I just haven't changed. It worked out great for me. And I'm still here.
So the other thing I'm supposed to ask our guests is if there's anything unusual, some habits or hobbies or something that you think people wouldn't know about you. Just people have no idea that lawyers are human beings. Sometimes they have unusual habits. Have you ever done anything unusual, or do you have any habits we should know about?
I have lots of habits, none of which you should know about. I do have a few skills. I'm pretty good in the domestic arts. I can make a wedding dress. I can sew. I can bake. I can cook. I can do all the wifely arts. I'm actually divorced and remarried, so I have a biological son of my own, and I also have two stepchildren. And so when I give advice to my clients and, you know, some of the topics we talk about here, I have some personal experience with, you know, the clothing wars and these like nightly phone calls that happen at your house. I have some ideas about them because I actually live them every day in my life. And so I think that helps inform my work. I also, which I probably should put in my background, I am also now being appointed as a guardian ad litem and as a child rep for children and domestic relations in Cook County. So I now also have the privilege of coming into people's houses and seeing how they live. And that has also changed some of my ideas about solutions to problems.
Well, we're very happy to have you. And it's your experience in law that we'll be tapping into now. But I can see where some of that, what you're saying, overlaps. And, you know, as mine, as a parent, sometimes I can use some of my teenager father, you know, my parenting experience. Maybe we could start on a more of an upbeat note. Best ideas in family law. Barry, do any come to mind, any techniques you've seen that you'd like our listeners to know about? Something that you're doing that you think, hey, that's a good tool out of my toolbox.
For me, I've learned that it's good to get the client's story up front. So when I meet a new client and I'm doing an interview, then let the facts be told in the client's own way. And then I get a better sense of what it's about, what the conflict is about, and what's most important to the client. Because at the end of the day, we want to meet the client's goals and give the client some idea of what's possible and what's not possible. And I have a unfortunate habit of sometimes telling the client, well, you can't do this, you can't do that under the law. And I have to put that in abeyance. I have to put that to the shelf and say, hey, wait a minute now. Let me find out what you want to do in this case. And let's see if we can find some way to do it.
I think what I can take away from that is it's important to have a goal. Sometimes, yeah. I sometimes think that when I meet people and they're involved in the legal system, their goal is to just get one over on the other side, or they like to fight, or, you know, or I've got to fight back, you know, and it's like, okay. And yeah, I try to slow down and say, well, what is the goal? And often it's simply phrased as live peacefully, raise healthy kids, have the money I'm supposed to get from the other side, maybe avoid constant bickering and communications that just drag you down. And, you know, the list is like three things. They lose. It's kind of like they get lost in the dust of, I'm going to fight. I'm going to file this. I'm going to do this. I'm going to get them. I don't know. What do you think, Sarah?
I agree. I think one of the things that I try to talk to my clients about is a wish list, right? You know, there's things that you want and there's things that are goals and they're kind of different, right? You can have the goal of, I want peace. You can have a wish list of, I want the top dollar amount contributed to child costs, right? But maybe you're not going to get the top dollar amount because, you know what, your ex got laid off and that's life. Okay. So, you know, what you want and what your goals are, knowing what those are and also what the differences between them is important. I also think that there's a lot that goes on for families that never actually gets in front of a judge. And I think that for people who are not in front of the courts every day, they don't really realize, we know you guys are fighting every day. We know that you're here with a GAL, and that means that the two of you bicker at least close to every single day. Because if you didn't do that, we wouldn't need three lawyers for two people. So there's some things that I think when it's your case, and I've had my case, I got divorced, and my case went all the way down to trial. I have done all of the things and stood there on the other side and gotten to have the heart palpitations that I've watched my clients have. Like I've had that, I want to say privilege, but I've had that experience. And I do think that there's so much that does not go in front of the court, and there's so much that does not go in front of the judge. And some of that stuff really should never be in front of the judge. And I think that figuring out how to understand that is important. And one of the things I think is actually a great thing that we have in domestic relations that's really like a part of our institution is sending families some mediation, because I got to tell you, I believe in mediation. I think mediation works. And I think that not every family can mediate things. People sometimes have personality disorders, or they're just so angry at each other, they're not ready. But I do think that mediation works. And I think that one of the reasons it works is because there's all these things to why you have a conflict, right? your conflict might be who gets the couch. Your conflict might be how much of the retirement account should I get, right? Your conflict might be, you know, should Bobby have speech tutoring, right? Whatever your conflict is, there's this whole host of information and there's these stories that are part of your life and why you have this conflict, and only some of it is judge appropriate. But frequently for people to get resolution and get peace, they actually need to address the whole conflict. And I think mediation is a great structure in which to do that.
Can I just have you clarify, what is mediation?
Sure. Mediation is a process in which a third party neutral, and if you have lawyers, your lawyers can be involved in it. If you have lawyers, they don't have to be involved in it. So it's also a nice way to manage costs. But it's where a third party neutral, frequently a lawyer or a psychologist or a retired judge, will basically listen to the sides of the stories and guide you through the communications in order to help you get an agreement. Because part of what the mediators do is they help people change the way they communicate. And then because you change the way you communicate, you can kind of change the way you look at it from talking about your position. You know, I want 50% of the house. I want the dog, right? Your position to your interests, right? I want a fair share of the things that we've grown during our marriage. I don't want to lose the bond I have with our pet, right? The second set are interests, the first set are positions. And when you rearrange how you look at what you want and what your goals are and what your wish list is, sometimes you can get a lot more than you maybe could have otherwise by coming to unique compromises. And that's pretty much what mediation is supposed to do.
I have seen some, in a sense, misunderstanding of the mediation process. I tell my clients, when you're going to mediation, don't try to convince the mediator that the other side is bad. Don't try to say,
correct,
well, you know, you don't understand. She's a bad mom. She don't understand what she's doing to me. You don't understand. And so, you know, like, they're not there to hear your argument why the other side is bad. They're just there to say, okay, what do you want? Like you said, your goals, your interests, whatever, and see if somehow they overlap, that some meeting of the minds can be arrived at, right? So all the effort I've seen, I've heard of this, because I don't usually go to the mediation. In fact, I don't think I ever have, except when I've conducted it myself or we've done things. I hear stories like, she spent the whole time bad mouthing me. It's like, okay, but my client knew that's not why they're there at mediation. It was to talk about the kids or the money, right? So I don't know what you say to your clients about that, but they can spend a lot of time trying to convince the mediator that they're right, but the mediator doesn't care. They just want to see, well, what do you want? What do you want, right?
And the reality is that mediation is a confidential process. So even if your wife, your ex, your husband, whoever, goes in and tells the mediator a terrible story, and you admit to the story and all the ways in which you're a really bad person, neither of you can have that mediator testify in the stand about how actually one of you is really bad. Okay, the reality, it's a completely confidential process. I agree with you that sometimes my clients have come out of mediation and it's not been productive. I try not to send parties to mediation if I don't think it's going to be productive. I'd rather hold it out. You know, the reality is that if the two of you are bickering so much, or just one of you is so angry, okay, that mediation isn't going to be fruitful. It's a waste of time and it's a waste of resources, and maybe getting a couple other pieces in place so that everyone can feel less attacked and maybe a little less stressed out, you know, maybe sending you back to mediation after that would be helpful. One of the things, for example, I don't want to send people to mediation, for example, if they're split up and there's a kid and there's no child support flowing. Even if you don't agree about what the schedule should be, if one of you is doing the lion's share or one of you makes way more money than the other one, the fact that there's some basic money flowing so that everyone feels like they have what they need will make you more likely to get more time in mediation. I mean, there's just some things about, you know, everyone has to be sort of emotionally ready to come to the table and understand that there are strengths and weaknesses to their position and be willing to have some compromises.
Now, let me, for the sake of our listeners, let me clarify that we've been talking about mostly mediation as it involves parents and parent roles, parenting time, parent decision making. But what about financial mediation? So do these same ideas apply to, and what are your experiences with financial mediation?
I've actually done a decent amount of financial mediation. Generally, I don't do it unless you've got enough money that you probably need a lawyer. I mean, just to be candid, the reality is that, you know, for the most part, for you to really have a lot of stuff to have to hash out like that, you usually need to have a lot of stuff, right?
Yeah.
I mean, you probably maybe have a lot of debt, or maybe there's something about yourself that's complicated. You have a business, it's secured by debt that's not owned by the business. You have something complicated about the situation. Mediation of financial issues also, I think, is a little more fraught. And here's why. Because there's things that the court, even if you agree to it, mediation, there's things a court will not do in parenting with parenting issues because they think it's bad for kids. So you sort of have these guardrails up that if you go in and you're not a divorce lawyer and you don't have any background information about what's supposed to happen, you come up with an idea that's kind of unique in a way that maybe would make someone who does this all the time worried that, you know, it's not good for the kids. For example, living with one parent for 6 months straight and not talking to the other parent or seeing them, and then the next 6 months live with the other parent. This, for the most part, is almost universally bad for children. Okay.
And would be rejected by the professionals involved, right? The right. Judge. And
the judge is going to enter it. Right. The judge is not going to enter that. The judge could read that judgment and go, no, we're not doing this. They're going to decide that both of you make bad decisions, and they're going to appoint someone to help you make better decisions. Okay. So there's guardrails up when it comes to parenting issues that are not as strict as there are with financials. There are some financial arrangements that the courts will not enter. For example, spouse A gets all of the money and all of the stuff, and spouse B is going to go apply for Section 8 housing and food stamps, and the child's going to live with them, and spouse A isn't going to pay anything. Okay, the judges are not going to enter that. All right, but there's a whole lot between that and everyone gets an exact equal share of it that the courts are going to allow you to enter, which may or may not be that great of a deal for you, okay? And because you're not in the courtroom every day, you're self-represented, you're trying to figure, you don't have $1 million estate, right? So you're not going to get lawyers.
And right. Let's face it, financial mediation is probably for people who have enough money to hire a lawyer too, right?
Well, but that's what I'm going to say is that technically anyone can go to mediation on any of the issues. But I would caution you that if you don't have enough money that you think it's worth it to get a lawyer, I would caution you to participate in financial mediation without at least doing some basic discovery and also having a lawyer advise you about what the range is of stuff that they think you could get if you went to hearing. Because there's no reason for you to agree to get way less than what you could have gotten in front of a courtroom. The judge is free. I mean, once you pay your filing fee, okay, essentially the judge's time is free, right? You pay your filing fee of, I don't know, whatever, it's $350 or whatever it is now. And you don't pay per court date. Like you paid that and that covers the judge, all the clerks, the sheriff, all the paperwork. Okay.
Right. Yes.
So don't go giving away, you know, $100,000 worth of a retirement account that you could have gotten a share of, which would only have cost you $1,000 to get. And also you wouldn't have had to have paid penalty taxes on it if only you knew something about how to divide retirement accounts. Okay, don't go making bad financial deals that can't be undone because you just did spend $500 to go talk to someone and get some basic ideas about what should happen. Also, I'm a true believer in this. You cannot waive something you don't know about. So if the two of you don't do a financial affidavit each about what you got and what you owe and where your money goes and who you live with, right? Then there's no way you can't waive your right in a house you didn't know existed. Right.
So you've mentioned a couple of things, Claire. One is discovery.
Yes.
To the lay listener, what are you talking about? What is discovery?
Discovery is the process of discovering the stuff relevant to your case.
So you send things. You send a subpoena to an employer. Maybe that would almost take a lawyer to know what to do. Or you send a notice to produce or a request for production. Those are the same thing, different names. Or you send a list of questions. The standard ones called interrogatories usually are used. But that Those then have 28 days to respond. It's a formal process of requesting things, getting documents, complaining that they didn't give you everything, back and forth it goes, right?
And so, but even before you get to that part of discovery, remember here in Cook County and also in many counties, not just Cook, the reality is that we all sort of play along with the game of I'll show you mine if you show me yours, right? And the way that we do that in domestic relations is a financial affidavit. You can download the form and all the instructions from the Illinois Supreme Court website. It's about a 10-page document. It's long. It's daunting. Yes, I filled one out. They're miserable. I'm so sorry you have to do it. But they're awful and everyone has to do one.
You can Google Illinois statewide financial affidavit and it'll pop up with the kit and the instructions and everything, right?
Yeah, and it comes, I think, in English and Spanish and maybe Polish. I mean, there's a bunch. It comes in a bunch of different languages. So,
right.
You know,
I tell people, you start filling that out right away because yes. It's going to be required. And it starts to structure their mind about what they owe, what they have, and right. So
let me jump in at that point of financial affidavit because I've done so many of those.
Haven't we all?
and there's a continuum where I'll send one perhaps to my client, say, yeah, let's work together to fill this out. And it'll come back wonderfully complete. And every page has been worked out. And I have all the information I need. And then I have the other extreme, unfortunately, where the client has skipped pages. And it's maybe someone's written in pencil. And coffee stains are on it, you know.
Yes.
So, and I say, well. And I try to send them a letter. I say, well, I'm still missing on page 2, paragraph 5. I need this information and page 4. So I have to go through it, kind of winnow through it. And so it might be good. I guess my best idea out of that process would be perhaps sit with someone you trust in the financials. And it could be a lawyer if someone's representing themselves, but sit with someone maybe who helps you do your tax return or whatever, and just say, well, what is this question looking for? What do I need to produce? And how shall I fill this out? Because I think for a majority of my clients, they're kind of scratching their head saying, well, I just didn't fill that out because I didn't know what it wanted. I don't know what you want on that page.
Well, and here's the thing, right? It's a part of the discovery process. So what you're doing is you're writing little numbers and you're making pithy little phrases, which are summarizing information that in theory, you should be able to back up with a piece of paper. So if you have to fill one out, the easiest way to do is, you know, there's like this free program called Mint, where it will tell you what you spend eating out every month and what you spend on childcare every month. Essentially, it's auto-tabulating for you, that program, essentially the numbers that you're supposed to be putting into your financial affidavit. If you look at your financial affidavit and it goes, rent or mortgage, and you write down $1,500. In theory, there should be a piece of paper where you paid someone $1,500 for the place you live at, whether or not it's a landlord or it's a bank or it's your roommate. Okay. In theory, there should be some piece of paper that backs that up. So if what you're really doing is paying your roommate $1,290, then write down $1,290 because actually that's what the piece of paper will back up. Because this is what's going to happen. You're going to write down a bunch of numbers. Do you think are like your, like, it's not a budget. It's not like a, it's not an aspirational document. Okay, you're just right. Going to have to admit to the fact that you spend $100 a month at Starbucks buying little sandwiches and coffees that you don't need. Okay. I never eat at Starbucks. I only drink tea from home. I don't. Okay. I go to McDonald's. I eat fast food. When I fill out my financial affidavit, I have to admit to the reason why I am not my ideal weight. And a lot of it has to do with McDonald's and Starbucks and Dunkin' Donuts. Okay. And I just have to admit to it. It's not a document about what you want to be or how you imagine yourself. It's supposed to be a document about right now, real life. It also is supposed to explain things about your life. For example, okay, if you fill out the document and at the bottom of the document, it says, I make $4,000 a month. And I have $6,000 in expenses and you have zero debts. Everyone knows that you lied about $2,000 every month. $2,000 a month is $24,000 a year that you have failed to identify where it comes from.
Right.
Now, there's another point that Claire makes here that I think is a very important one. There's a line on the financial affidavit, any particular line, it could mean several things. So it could be rent or mortgage or paying the roommate. And so that's something else. Someone will come to me and say, well, what do they really want on that line? I don't pay this or that. And I say, well, if you need to explain what it is, then you put a footnote at the bottom of the page. And the footnote says, well, my roommate was paying this for the first 6 months. And then in July, I began paying $1,290. And so the beauty of a footnote at the end of the page, then the light comes on for my client. Oh, I can explain it. You know, so they're not straitjacketed in to just, what number do I put on that line?
And I talk to clients about making the numbers defensible. That's my own phrase. But I say a defensible number is one that can be argued to make sense. I mean, like what Claire was saying, you know, it matches what your mortgage statement or your what you say you have in the bank matches your latest statement. And often it'll ask you, not often, but you're supposed to put down bank balances, things like that. So I'll put down, $125.49 as of the date. Well, that'd be the most recent statement available. And so sometimes I'll even attach the first page of all the recent bank statements, not a whole raft of stuff, but just attach it to the affidavit. So those numbers are clearly on the first page of every bank, of all the bank statements, right? The latest one from Chase, latest one from Fifth Third, latest one from Harris. That way, when you're saying these numbers, you're not just blowing smoke. It's right there on the statement.
I'll say this, though. If Kevin sends me a financial affidavit and I only get one page or statement, you bet your boots I'm going to ask for the rest of the pages. Discovery is not about giving the information you want to give. Discovery is about giving all of the information. In America, we do not do trial by surprise. You may not just blank out the parts of your bank account or your pension or whatever that you don't want the other side to know. The moment you take a little black marker and you color off a piece of something on a piece of paper is the moment I know that that information is really interesting to me and I want it. And I'm going to go do a lot of things to get it. So it's social security numbers. You should cross out your social security numbers. But, for the most part, you get excited.
You're absolutely right.
Page. Yeah, no, Kevin, you're absolutely right. He sends me one page. My answer is, hey, Kevin, where's the rest of my pages?
Well, no, where's the rest of the 3 years? So I know that that's not that's not the full thing of discovery. But what it does is make for a less, of a packet, like the financial affidavit plus the first pages of all the statements just makes for maybe a 15-page document instead of a bundle, And coming soon would be, 3 years back and all the usual exchange that goes on, right? But it's just a way of saying this number has a basis in a reality. But there's a 10-page bank statement, but you just, the first page just goes attaching to my financial affidavit. That's
the other thing as an aside in discovery that I'll say is this, which is something lawyers know and people who are not lawyers for the most part really don't know. It's really simple. You're supposed to produce things that the other side doesn't have that are in your possession and control. Okay. What that means is, even though you never opened up the mail and threw it out, you can go get a copy of the bank statement, the credit card statement. You have to go get it, right?
Yes.
But also, it's a joint bank statement. It's a joint tax return. You're not allowed to harass your spouse by asking them to produce 5 years of your joint bank account that you already have, of the joint tax return that you already have, of stuff that you know is already in your possession, but you're just trying to make them do stuff because you want to like spin their wheels and make them do stuff because you're mad at them. That's not what discovery is for. It's to go get stuff the other side doesn't already have. So when they send a request for all of things that they're all in their possession, I want you to produce all of, I'm the wife and I want you to produce all of my 401k statements. You tell them it's in your possession control. You produce them.
Right. Exactly. So we've covered, we've talked about mediation. We touched on financial affidavits. We talked about a little bit about discovery and can get to be a mishmash of things, but it's probably, there's two categories there. One is trying to reach agreement because it's more economical, right? And the discovery part is knowing enough to reach agreement, right? A lot of these cases settle, but discovery is one way of knowing that you're not getting snookered. If they did win the lottery or whatever, and sometimes people are very deceptive, and who would be that way? And but people think, well, and I did have a case I'll never forget where I did subpoena the bank, and I asked the bank to give us the bank statements, and then I got them from the other party. And my assistant compared them, and I'll never forget, like it's yesterday, they said, Kevin, these two January statements are different. And I said, impossible. It's impossible. And I looked at them and I said, you're right. And they'd actually used whiteout or some technology to change around some of the transactions because some of the money was going to a girlfriend. Wow. So they actually altered the bank statements just a little. And we never would have known except we got them from the bank also. So that's just a note. So if you're thinking, by the way, about wow. altering, like you mentioned with a pen, but sometimes even more creative with whiteout and then recopy it and stuff like that. And there's technology right now to whiteout documents. If you're thinking about altering bank statements or pension statements or anything else, give that a second thought. Because when we got in front of the judge.
That's yes. called fraud upon your spouse, fraud upon the court. And you get nailed on that. Oh, there is no, after the judge has figured out that you have lied to them, yes. they yes. will never forgive you. And they keep little notes. Judges have these little notebooks, but they keep little notes about your case. And if they have in there, lied to me, defrauded spouse by producing false documents, every time they're going to highlight that in yellow. And every time they open up the notes in your case, be like, all right, what's going on in the case? They'd be like, oh, this is the person that's the fraudster. And everything you say to the court, they'd be like, I don't believe that you served them with notice. I don't believe that that's your bank account. I don't believe that that's what you earn. I don't believe you only have one job. And now all of a sudden your case is going to cost $1 million and it's going to go forever because the judge yes. is never going to want to give you anything that you want because they're going to think you're lying to them.
Oh my gosh, yes. And the thing is, it might be a financial thing. That, you know, maybe your case involves finances, parenting time, decision-making, kids, money, it's all mixed together. But once you're caught up in lying on the finances, then the judge is very unlikely to believe you on the important parenting stuff either.
That's since, right. Because a liar's a liar's a liar.
Right. Yes. If you're right. not, you know, you think, well, it was just a little fudging of the finances. It's not really, I'm still a good dad and I want all my time. But now you might find yourself swimming upstream to get anyone to believe you, you know, well, but she did this and she did this. And they might think, well, I remember that thing you filed was wrong or that, you know, one of the most precious commodities I sometimes tell people is your credibility with the judge and with other people in the system. So just don't think that you can fudge things and it's never going to haunt you. It may come back at an inopportune time. Right. So
yes. Now let me tack on to that. Another area besides the written document, there's also the opportunity to tell the story in a deposition. And now a deposition would be either side can ask for a deposition, which is an interview outside of court before a court reporter with a sworn statement, but from the other side to get at those things that perhaps the other side wants to keep hidden. And it's also an opportunity for the party to kind of fudge and hem and haw or be belligerent. And that's a whole nother topic. I think, Kevin, you and I.
Oh, the belligerent deposition.
No, that never happens. I just did a deposition yesterday. No, there's not a bit of pushback. No.
No comments, is all I'm going to say. No comment on the belligerence.
Okay. For our lay listeners, I think we need to define terms. What is a deposition? And
well, I think Barry defined it pretty well. It's an opportunity where one side interviews the other side. It's a sworn statement under oath. So you're going to promise not to lie. And you're going to do it in front of a court reporter who's going to take down everything. And at the end of it, you have the right to review the transcript and sign it and say, yes, that's what happened. Or you can waive your right to sign it. I mean, look, they're court reporters. I know that it seems like, you know, everything is fragile and everyone could be on the take or whatever. But the reality is this, court reporters listen to people tell depositions all day, every day. They make good money at it. Depositions are very expensive. Transcripts are very expensive. And odds are if there's a mistake in it, it is an honest mistake.
Well, our listeners often wouldn't have an attorney, but they may be called to a deposition. And what they can expect now in the Zoom era, I've been doing them on Zoom. I'm sure the day will come where we're back into sweaty conference rooms. But what's called upon is you to show up on time. Usually the deposition notice that you receive has a rider. Maybe it asks you for 4 or 5 documents or more. You're supposed to bring what you can. And those will be emailed to the other side. Then show up on Zoom.
And usually they ask for them a few days in advance. They usually want you to give your documents before the deposition. And some depositions, like if you're a business or some kind of third party, some depositions you can get out of having to answer questions by talking to someone if you just give them the documents early enough.
Like you see that sometimes in subpoenas that go out. They threaten the business. You must be here on this day and time, but you could just give us documents, give us his employment file and all his pay records, and you don't have to show up. Yeah, the way it's phrased. But to summarize then, it's just you talking, answering questions with a court reporter, dutifully taking down everything, recording. You want to speak clearly, answer the questions, but know that everything you say can and will be used against you. So it's better to slow down the pace, listen to the question carefully, and then answer. Rambling or spewing is frowned upon. It's not a good idea. And what am I talking about? Well, it's the style of questioning I was taught has a name. This is not deposition training, but the point is that the deponent, the witness, begins to explain, and then they go beyond explaining. They start to spew, or they just start to go. You know, it's like, and narrative. as a witness, don't spew. Don't, you know, answer the question and be quiet. Wait for the next question. The urge to explain during a deposition is so strong. It's actually strong during court, too. To get on the stand and they ask you a question and you answer, and then the questioner looks at you quizzically like, you know, that quizzical, like, you know, and but you don't understand this. And then they start to explain. The other person just smiling because, go for it. Just pour it out.
Oh, yeah. Those are the best depositions when they just start talking and start telling you stuff. Listen, the moment your mouth runs is the moment your mouth runs away with you. Here's the thing, though, Kevin. And this is, I think, the thing that's sort of when you don't do it all the time, you don't do it every day. Actually, when you're the person answering questions, it's not actually your time to tell your story. Pretty much, that's actually not actually what your job is. Your job is not there to tell your story. Your job is there to answer questions. So if they ask you a question that sort of presumes something, here's the classic one all lawyers know. Bob Jones, when did you stop beating your wife? Objection. Assuming facts that have not been presented. He's never beaten his wife, right? This is like this very classic, like, example from law school. Okay. They're asking you questions because they're trying to get you to give them information that supports their story.
Right.
Okay. They're not asking you questions so that you can explain how you're right. That's not the point of them spending much money to take your deposition. Doesn't make any sense.
And what you say in a deposition will never see the light of day unless it hurts you.
Yes.
You can even get the printed copy, you know, the transcript at great expense, $4.50 a page or whatever. You could get the printed version of what you said.
They like cost $1,000 or more. Just so the people listening understand, depositions are serious. Like when you have like 2 lawyers and a court reporter and you have to take time off of work and you guys are married, your family essentially spent like $6,000 on that day. Just so you understand like how much money goes in, because the lawyers all spend basically at least an hour of prep time for each hour of deposition. And the deposition is going to be 3 hours, because why would we take less than all of our
hours? I take less than 3 hours because the cost of the transcript gets mountainous. So if I can, I try to shave it to, 2 hours if I can. But
I'll say this. If I don't have to take a deposition, I won't. If there's not something that I think is really missing from my case, I'm not going to spend the money on the deposition. But if I'm going to spend $4,000 on the deposition, I may as well spend $5,500 on the deposition. You know, if I'm going to have to sit there and take 2 hours to get out from you the fact that you have a girlfriend,
We're going to start talking about every single place you went and where you spent money on Zelle and who is Jenny Jones that you give $37 to every Thursday, because I've already spent the bulk of it, right? I've already spent at least, I mean, you can't walk out of a deposition without spending less than $1,500. And that's for like a 25-minute deposition. The first 10 minutes of the deposition are, what's your name? What's your address? Are you on any substances that would limit your ability to answer me truthfully today? Okay, that's the first like 10, 15 minutes deposition. I can ask 7 questions and I've already spent $1,500. So like, we may as well just go for it, you know?
I like it. That's a good way to look at it.
We've talked about the witness in a deposition, the person being interviewed, party, or could be somebody else called for deposition. And we talked about the deponent, the party talking too much. But there, the opposite extreme also occurs, where you have it, there's no right, Fifth Amendment right, to not say anything. So you can't come to deposition and fold your arms and say, well, I'm not going to answer that question. Well, you have to answer the question.
You're going to go see the judge when you're done.
That's right. So you can't say, I don't think you need to know that. And you can't answer the question with a question. And so,
it's not a date. That's it's a right. One-sided interview. Yes, that's right.
Mr. Jones, do you think you're a good father? Well, what do you think? Are you a good father? No. I'm the one asking the questions then.
I shouldn't give away all my secrets, but one of the questions in a deposition I always try to ask that they're always resistant to answering. You know, I ask about the ex or the other party or the husband. Say, so is Bob a good father? And oh my gosh, I get every possible answer. Whoa, what do you mean, good father? Counsel, you have to ask more specific. It's like the worst question.
Hold on though, Kevin. Who doesn't prep their client for that? I mean, I have literally had trials. I remember we used to actually go to the courthouse. I'd be like in the elevator. I'd be like, here's the deal. Be like, if you don't want to lose, you're going to have to come up with something nice to say about your husband. Come up with something that's right. Not he's pretty. You got to come up with something, anything. Yes. Give it thought. Call me tomorrow. You have to have a positive thing that you can say about your soon-to-be ex. Anything. Yes. They play well together. My kid likes making brownies with them. They both have the same sense of humor. Something positive that makes it look like this is not just you out for blood. Yes.
Oh my gosh, that's a good way to say it. I like what you said. Now, for our listeners who might think that this is a war, this is a scorched earth, fight to the death, I'm going to fight for my rights, I'm going to fight for my kids, they're not perceived very well by judges and others if they come in and it's, like you said, it's just everything's negative, you know, and that way, it sounds like more like they can be dismissed as someone who's just on a rant. It's just an angry rant. Unfortunately, not accurate. They're just ranting, right?
Oh, Kevin, on that actual point, I had a client who requested for me to refer to Sun Tzu's Art of War, this classic.
That book says in my breezy review of it, the art of the war is at the basis of it is deception. So it's all about, you know, deceiving the enemy as to your motives and outflanking him. But deception is at the heart of the art of war, as far as you know. So I don't think we can carry
that. So if I'm representing someone, I said, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to do that.
Yeah,
do that. I'm sorry.
I'm not in the revenge business. It's not actually what I do. Yeah.
Also, I tell people that acting on principle is very expensive. And you might be better off.
It's also not what domestic relations is about. These are not courts of principle.
It's the principle of the thing. Well,
no,
wait a minute.
The moment I've never had a client tell me it's a keep in mind, right? Look, I don't work for a nonprofit. I work for money. Okay. The reality is money makes offices run, right? Money, you got to pay your bill to me so I can pay the people that I hired for you, the accountant, the court reporter, et cetera. You got to pay me so I can pay the secretaries so payroll can be covered, rent can be covered, insurance. So that I don't, in case I get sick, insurance, in case I make a mistake, right? Like money makes the machine run. And the moment a client tells me, well, it's the principal thing, is the moment I know they're going to stop paying me because there is no principal of the thing. There is just
on the other hand,
what the family needs and what it costs. And that's it.
Claire, if you ever had a client tell you, I'd rather pay you than pay my spouse.
Yes.
Have you ever had a
Yes, and I'd like to point out, I did an excellent job for that client. He did not have to pay college expenses. He did not have to pay maintenance. I did an absolutely excellent job for that client. He said he would rather pay me than pay his ex-wife, and he is still paying me to this day. He is paying me mass. It's probably in the end would have cost him, I mean, for the amount of money that he paid me, he probably could have paid for some college. I mean, if he had just agreed to pay, I mean, he must have owed me in total over the whole case, $35,000. Has a lot of money he could have paid toward college expenses, but he didn't. He didn't want to pay, and I did a great job. Those poor kids.
Yeah.
So we've talked about maybe some good ideas. You know, things that like discovery, mediation, some techniques for testifying. You know what? Maybe we should just clarify what you were mentioning about saying something good about the spouse or saying something about that carries over not only in deposition but also in testimony, right? People end up
absolutely, and Kevin, does it carry over in testimony? The reality is, if you take the time to do that, it's actually, I think, going to actually help your case in the long run. Because here's the thing: you can come in like it's World War II and you're Russia and start burning down forests if you'd like to. Okay, but the reality is that when it's all over and the judge stamps the order that says off call, okay. And all the lawyers go home and all the professionals go home, whatever terrible secrets about your ex that you told everyone about, you still have to parent with that person. You still have to receive maintenance or pay maintenance to that person. You still have to deal with financial things. You guys have to come to agreements about summer camp and tutoring and medical issues with the person who you just embarrassed and who you were cruel to and who you set up on an emergency motion right after their mom died just to mess with them. Okay, you have to go live your life dealing with that person after all of us professionals leave. And people in your community are going to find out about what you did. And they're all going to know that you did that. And you're going to have to live with that in your community. And the question is it really worth it?
Your kids can grow up and read the court documents too.
They can.
You know, and the other side might not spare them the reading of the court documents. They might say, Jimmy, it's time you knew what kind of dad you have, you know, or something like that.
Yes. And I've literally had litigants say that to each other. Like me as a GAL had a husband say it to a wife, be like, when the kids are 18, I'm going to tell them all about this stuff. And it's like, oh, I mean, your kids are suffering now. Do they really need to suffer again when they're 18? I mean,
And some people, I think it should be said, some people don't spare their kids during the litigation, right?
But if they get busted at that, that you can pretty much courts will punish you for it. So if you do that during litigation, for the most part, and courts catch you, you're going to get nailed and you're going to lose parenting time.
Well, or discussing, Jimmy, how much time do you want to spend with your mom on weekends? Or what do you think your vacation time with your mom should be? Or asking kids about
terrible idea.
Terrible idea. Now, I've had people say, well, you know what, the kids should have some input because, you know, it's their parenting time. And I think, what planet are you from?
No.
It's because it's an adult decision.
Not just that, it's mean. Here's the thing that I think it's hard for litigants to understand, because as an adult, you think like an adult, you have responsibilities as an adult, right? But children don't think like adults, and they don't have adult responsibilities. Children understand, for the most part, that they have two parents. And in their mind, for most kids, they understand that part of me is my dad and part of me is my mom, right? Or if you have two moms, part of me is one of each of my moms, whatever. Two dads, same thing, right? But like, you know, they understand that they have two parents and they think of themselves as equally made up of those two parents. So when you sit there and you tell your kid, you know, daddy's a bad man, they think half of themselves is bad. When you say, do you love me more than you love dad? Do you want to live with me more than you live with dad? You ask this child to divide their loyalty and make choices about who they love. And that is mean.
I have a
it's
subtle
okay
more
for them to love their other parents.
Yes, I have a more subtle version of that attack. And that's, Bobby, do you want to go with your dad this weekend? He wants to have you this weekend. Do you want
that's
to
not,
go?
No.
You know,
kids don't decide parenting time. Kids don't decide bedtimes. Kids don't decide dinner time. It's not that complicated.
Now, there's a corollary to that, which is that when the kid becomes a teen and the parent asks the question and says, well, Bobby, No, Bobby comes to the parent and says, well, Mom, I don't want to go over to Dad's this weekend. It's boring over there. And Dad leaves for half the time and goes out drinking. And so Mom is horrified. Oh, well, should Bobby have to go if Dad is not paying attention the whole weekend to, you know, to Bobby?
Yes.
And so I get that question a lot.
The short version of the answer is yes. And as a GA, I will tell you that unless I hear something a lot worse than Dad went bowling on Saturday night and I didn't want to go with him, the answer is yes, Bobby's going. If Bobby's bored, Bobby can read a book. Books are good for you.
And one thing I say to people who think, well, the child doesn't want to go is, okay, so maybe the child doesn't want to do other things that are good for, like brushing teeth, eating vegetables, going to bed. If the child consistently refused to brush her teeth, what would you do, right?
Well, I'm gonna give you an example of something that's a little more complex. And I think that this is something that's actually common that happens. And I'm gonna analogize it to an intact family. And I think that will maybe also help people understand why us three have such a black and white view of this issue. So let's say the issue is not brushing your teeth or it's boring. Let's say the issue is Bobby and Dad got in a disagreement. Okay, Bobby got in trouble because, I don't know, he was out too late or he got bad grades. You know, maybe Dad's more of a disciplinarian. Maybe because Dad sees Bobby less, you know, the amount of time that Dad thinks that he's supposed to be enforcing these punishments goes on longer because he's only seeing Bobby 3 days a week, right? Instead of seeing Bobby every single day. Okay, so Bobby doesn't want to go because he's tired of being in trouble with Dad. Here's the thing. If Mom and Dad and Bobby lived in one house together and Bobby was mad at Dad, that Dad was still upset with him for, you know, staying out till 1 a.m. even though Bobby didn't want to spend time with Dad, Bobby would still see Dad every day at the breakfast table, in the kitchen, run into each other in the hallway, and the issue in their relationship would start to move, okay? Opportunities for conversations about things other than being in trouble would happen, okay? People don't bond over deep, complex conversations about what's wrong with each other. Okay. People bond over fun things. People bond over food. People bond over everyday activities like watching TV. Like, it's just a thing about human beings and how we function. Like, humans don't bond over those big, complex, deep, dark things. Humans bond over the everyday experiences that make you a unit, right? But the problem is when you're in a divided house and Bobby's only seeing Dad once every 5 days or something, all those times for that emotional issue between Bobby and Dad to just naturally ease out in the household, many of them are just not available because Bobby and Dad aren't spending the time together. So if you don't make Bobby go so that he and Dad can work their problems out together themselves, the relationship is, for the most part, going to start to wither. And it's not good for children to learn that the way that you manage problems in long-term relationships is to avoid them until the relationship withers. You teach children how to not have a long-term relationship. Right. How are they going to solve those long-term relationships with their significant others, with their spouses, with their siblings, if you don't teach them that, hey, even when you're not getting along with your family member, you have to go spend time with them. You have to go have dinner with them. I love my husband. When I'm mad at him, I still have to live with him. And that's good for us because that's part of how you work through discord.
Maybe you're going to teach them that when there's an argument at the kitchen table with their spouse eventually, that the answer is to get away from them. Go out, slam the door and leave because, you know, it's too painful to deal with. It's too uncomfortable to deal with. Well, in the past, when it was uncomfortable, I just got away from the person, you know?
Yeah, and I never had to face it. And I never had to learn how to, you know, maybe Dad's got a point. Maybe staying out till 1 a.m. wasn't just the only problem. Maybe you came back smelling alcohol with his car and you could have killed someone and him being mad at you is completely justified.
So,
and you're lucky little doc, he's not the police, right? Yeah. Like there might be things that need to be communicated about this issue that you avoid by having them not learn how to face their mistakes, because learning how to face your mistakes is how you learn to be a better person.
So the forcing the child in the car issue where they say, well, I can't force him to get in the car. I can't make him go see his dad.
Then you're a weak parent. I'm being honest with you. I force my child in the car all the time. I force him in the car for school every morning. He wants to sleep in. He goes to school.
You can bring down the ceiling on him. You can say, well, fine. If you're not going to go, then no TV, no screen time. Give me your phone, whatever, you know.
That's right.
Bring it home to them that there's going to be consequences.
Or this classic line, that's fine. We'll talk about it in the car.
Yeah. Well, Claire, we're really glad you could come today. And we just have a few minutes left. I am sorry for that rusty chair that we sat you in over there. And we will validate your parking and we'll go out and find your car in the parking lot with you. But can you, is there anything you'd like to tell our listeners? Like the final moments of don't forget this, or please remember this, or don't do this, whatever you do. Are there any things that in the final minutes you think of that you want to tell people?
Sure. I mean, I think if I was gonna wrap up on what I think are the most important things that we've talked about, I think that, you know, being honest in your court case, not sharing extraneous information, but being honest, right? Not telling lies in your court case is important. Understanding that you have to know what's going on in order to make choices in your case. So for example, the discovery issue. And also that at the end of the case, when all the orders are entered, you still have to go and parent with this person that you don't get along with right now. And there is really a thing that happens over time after a couple years when, you know, your emotions have started to settle and each of you have continued to move forward in your lives, in which, you know, the things that you are upset about, you may still be upset about them, but you're going to be able to put them to bed. And you don't want to make that process harder or longer by picking fights that aren't going to fruit you any benefit.
Kevin, I love the title of our topic today, which was the best of ideas and the worst of ideas. And I'm sure you borrowed it from the Charles Dickens novel, Tale of Two Cities, which begins very similarly. It was the best of times. It was the worst of times. And I think that's what happens in a divorce, that in some sense, it's the worst of times. You're going through something you never thought you'd go through. But it's always the best of times. You find a strength that you never thought you would have as you go through the process, and you find out things that you never knew about yourself, about the kids maybe, and about the other party. And I'd say my final tip would be just find some way to show kindness to even in the difficult circumstances, to show kindness where you are, to be generous and to forgive. And because you're just doing that really, and it benefits yourself as well as everyone else.
I heard who did I hear this one time say, will this be important in 10 years? You know, the thing that you're fighting over, you know, I want that couch, or I've got to have that, or something, you know, will it be important in 10 years? And another thing I've heard people wrongly say is, well, I only have to deal with them until the kids are 18. It's like, what? No, you have to deal with them the rest of your life. There'll be scheduling of college graduation and you only get 3 tickets. Who gets to come? There'll be who's going to attend a wedding, and will they sit next to each other, or, you know, in the front row, or, you know, you're never going to get this person out of your life. So there's no turnover your parental rights. We know in Illinois, in normal domestic relations, not juvenile, there's no way to sign away your rights. So I'm just, okay, fine, I'll just sign away my rights. There's nothing like that. There isn't a process. So adoption does provide that, because if they find a new person, they can adopt, you can have your rights terminated. But if you think you're just going to walk away, no obligations, yeah, no rights, but no obligations, not happening. So you're stuck. And we're just, I think all of us are like, why don't you make the best of this bad situation, right? And get on with your life. I think it's a very expensive place to work through your anger issues.
yes, it is.
Yeah. And if the less fearful you can be, the less angry you're going to be too. I think often anger is the flip side of fear. So if we can somehow, you know, just have a little bit less fear, find that spiritually or whatever, just have a lot less fear, maybe, you know, less anger. Well, I don't think we got clearly where people should call you, Claire, if they would like to consult with you. Can you give your phone number very clearly?
Absolutely. I'm a lawyer at Hoffenberg and Block. Our phone number is 312-853-8000. We're also on the web at chicagofamilylawyer.com.
Very good. And in our episode notes, we'll have a link to Claire and her firm. Probably you have a page in your firm's website, right?
Yes.
So that we'll put it in the episode notes. We'll make sure there's a link. Some people don't read the episode notes, but there'll be a link to Claire's website and her profile there. Well, Claire, we're glad you could spend time with us during your busy day. I hope that Cher didn't give you a backache that you're sitting on over there. We'll go out now and try to find your car in the parking lot, see if it's been damaged. Thank you all for being here with us on episode 38. I'm attorney Kevin Johnson.
I'm attorney Barry Boykin.
And I'm attorney Claire McMahon.
And we'll see you next time. Thank you.